Did you know that the original Final Fantasy creator, Hironobu Sakaguchi, made a spiritual successor to that legendary series called Fantasian for Apple Arcade, and every level in the game is a handmade, physical miniature model? Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a 1 month free trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. This offer is for new subscribers only. $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled. Hello and welcome to Pixel Sift Platinum Edition. If you're wondering what I'm on about, this is our 20th episode, and a modern gift for the 20th anniversary is platinum. So be that platinum of the metal kind or platinum of the Pokemon kind, we'll leave it up to you. As usual, I'm joined in the studio by my co-hosts Mitch and Scott.
Hey, hey.
Hey.
On today's episode, we're talking video games that are so bad, they might even be good. Almost guilty pleasures, if you will.
Yes, and for this week's interview,
I'm Fabian Malabello, and I'm the director of the Otherworld Agency.
Yeah, Fabian brings video game devs and music creators together, and we talk to him about what's involved when bringing sound into a game.
And finally, Mitch.
Yeah, so finally we'll be talking about the changing attitudes of gamers as they get older and how do they approach the games they play.
All that and more on today's 20th episode of Pixel Sift.
Did you know Pixel Sift is available on other platforms? You can find previous episodes on iTunes, Pocket Casts, YouTube, and on the Pixel Sift website.
Now, as people get older, their motivations change, and the things that they once found important as a young child tend to fade away. And new research coming out of Quantic Foundry has shown that motivations for gamers change as well. Isn't that right, Mitch?
Yeah, so they found that over time that like the priorities of gamers in regards to certain aspects of their gaming lives actually kind of shift, just like, you know, attitudes towards everything else in life. So they found, interestingly enough, we've got a couple of things here, competitive nature is something that really fizzles out in regards to gamers as they get older.
Yeah. So how many people did they survey to sort of find these results?
Yeah, so they've surveyed roughly, I think, about 200,000 people so far. I think, wait, hang on, it's a bit more than that. Hang on.
It's 100. I think it was about 144, and I think more people sign up and do it all the time, basically. Yeah. But it's a self-reported sort of survey.
That was the number that was on the site, but I'm pretty sure it's more by now.
Yeah.
Also, a couple of other things. So I guess the gamer's gender is actually pretty much split down the middle, only slightly favoring the male side. That's also kind of interesting.
I did read a stat from 2014, I believe, that said that in the UK, the percentage of gamers did outweigh 52% to the females, just slightly overtaking.
Really?
I thought that was just, I'll jump in with that interesting fact. I thought that was good.
Yeah. It's interesting because with this particular thing, it's a survey that people kind of click on and do their own sort of, you know, they sign up themselves basically to do it. So for people who, there's probably a difference between people who self-identify as a gamer versus someone who is, we would technically consider a gamer, someone who plays games. Mm. And there's been some research about this that there are a large proportion of women who play games, but they don't necessarily identify with the label of gamer.
For various reasons.
For various reasons.
Well, not bad, but all the other things, that the baggage that comes along with being a gamer.
There can be lots of things for that, but yeah. So I guess the interesting fact that's come out of this is, as they've done lots of different sort of profiles on people who do these particular gaming profiles to sort of see what thing, sort of things people are interested in, but they've just, the trend basically shows a pretty clear sort of trend throughout, as people kind of get older throughout their lives.
Yeah, they just don't seem to want to, I guess, compete against each other as much as they used to.
So is multiplayer competitive gaming, is that a young person's game?
I guess so, if you these stats to be believed. But like something that still like everyone seems to be across the board with, old or young, seems to be strategy. Everyone seems to value it pretty high on the list of you know, priorities regarding games and attitudes.
I think it's one of those things that is, I guess, an enduring trait of many different games and can be in sort of lots of different ways. And, you know, someone could read it and say, oh, look, strategy is, you know, like real-time strategy games or turn-based strategy games or something like that. But there are lots of strategies that you can use in all sorts of different games. For example, you know, take a game like Dark Souls, for example, where you've got such a, you know, a limited amount of life and you have to play in a particular strategic way. And even if you're not playing a, you know, a multiplayer strategy, you will need to employ strategies in order to get the best and get what you want out of games.
Yeah, like regarding, and then also something else they've realized is that overall motivation for gamers actually tends to decline. So they can tend to become less passionate, I guess, as it goes along.
That's all right. I mean, some people grow out of hobbies and interests. Like, I mean, I very much doubt that's going to happen with us, I'd say. But, you know, because games are going to keep evolving and whatever. But, like, the way I felt about games 10 years ago v now is a huge difference. You know, like, especially when I started, I was up for any type of game, you know, for any duration of time kind of thing. Like, even a few years back with Skyrim, like, when that first came out, I was all about it, all into it. And then, you know, I lose legs quicker these days with games. I don't know if it's we're being too spoilt and it's like an oversaturation or something, but it takes more to hold me into video games these days. And you're right with the real-time strategy thing. I feel that's a great example. I'm more, even though I've always loved that kind of, that genre of gaming, I'm more into it now because of my ability to just play with myself, so to speak.
Play a short game that you don't need to rely on other people to be jumping in on it. I find with you know, games as you go along, and any hobby really, that you kind of have, you kind of go in a bit of a cycle. You go up and down in your interest and things like that. And if you are playing a competitive game, you can't sort of, that doesn't mesh with most hobbies, because you need to be fully into it and you need to commit to it, because a competitive game where you have to keep on top of stuff and improve your skills, if you stop, you get left behind and then the game isn't super
fighting. There's a certain amount of investment that has to be, I guess, committed to when you play a competitive game and you really want to be top of, you know, that particular tier. I guess it's also like the younger someone is, the more disposable time they have. Also, like, they're not really working and they're not really...
interests are still things that are, more aimed at that kind of age. You know, like, as you get older, you only have more things to worry about and, you know, have to deal with in your life. Whereas when you're a kid, you can kind of focus on video games as, like, your priority number one. But real-time strategy is a really good example, I feel. Like, when I was younger, I used to play the crap out of Total Annihilation, like, pretty competitively, just within my friends, because, like, you know, dial-up was pretty poor back then. But now, like, I want to play the same games, RTS style, but I'm more into, you know, designing a really nice kind of fort and whatever, and have everything in neat little positions and have my walls up around my city and stuff. And I get a lot of satisfaction out of that now, I guess, compared to when I was younger.
I used to play a lot of online multiplayer games, and that big thing for me was that you were either competing with your friends, and some of your friends now, as you kind of get to a different age brackets, maybe don't play the same games as you, or they'll play on different things. So, you know, if you haven't got those people there to kind of pull you along with it, and you haven't all got the time to kind of devote to it, you don't tend to put the same amount of time in for these things.
I found it interesting how some of the stats pointed towards that older gamers care more about single player and not playing with other people and, like, not being competitive. But, like, with things like achievements, it kind of makes the single player campaign kind of competitive, because then you can get these certain achievements and certain amount of score, and you can compare that to your friends.
Yeah, I mean, that's self-imposed competition though, and it's probably something that, again, the older generations aren't going to be as up for, I guess. I don't know, I just forgot my point.
Yeah, no worries.
Yeah, it is something that, I guess, and as we should say, that all of these things are surveys, so, you know, this isn't the be-all and end-all rule for everyone. There is going to be some people out there who may be, you know, in their 60s and they love playing Call of Duty online, and that's their absolute favorite thing, so it's a generalized sort of statement. We know, though, there are some facts we know about sort of the average gamer now, that most people would think that the average gamer would be your, you know, young person playing multiplayer shooters, but they're actually quite a bit older than that. The average, the Electronic Software Association in, or the Entertainment Software Association, sorry, in the United States. They run the E3 convention. They have an average age. Do you have that age there, Mitch?
Yes, the average age is 35, which it hasn't moved at all since, I think, the last statistics were taken about 3 years ago.
Yeah, I think the 2011 report showed the average was 37 or something.
Oh, okay.
But that's still pretty close. It's only within a couple of years. So.
Yeah.
That's just because people have been born. And
yeah. I mean, there are lots of organizations putting together stats, and the Entertainment Software Associations is a bit of a go-to, especially for the US market. But I mean, a more recent one that I was able to grab hold of was 2015 Global Gaming Stats, which said the average gamer was 31. So regardless of who's exactly accurate, we're in the 30s. Like, that, the average gamer is in his 30s.
Yeah, and there's also, you know, there's an average of 2 gamers per household, and 4 out of 5 houses game on play video games.
It's a lot of people who are doing it. It makes you wonder whether the high profile multiplayer online games that they are really pushing, the high budget ones, are the games that the vast majority of people are really going to be playing, and whether it would be better to kind of push it towards the people as their competitive interest wanes to maybe think about different sorts of games. And we can
another reason why I don't like to play online and in multiplayer and stuff is because I don't like kid chatter. I don't like the cat chatter that all these kids are doing. They're terrible.
They're punk kids. They're on my
damn
virtual
kids
lawn
these days.
And they're
on your digital lawn.
On my digital lawn. And with that, let's go into our next segment.
Get off it.
So, video game sound is a massive industry, as we all know. The ever-growing technical quality of audio in video games has stretched out into how we consume real-world activities, such as sports, etc. This week, we spoke to Fabian Malabello, who's an agent for composers and sound designers working in the video game industry.
So, my title is, I guess, audio director, managing director, yeah, somewhere between that. The Other World Agency is kind of like an all audio solutions company for video games. So we'll do everything from composition, music licensing, sound design, voice acting, even implementation, audio direction. If, you know, the game developers have like an in-house composer and sound designer, we help to bring out the best in what they do and match what they're doing to the game that's at hand.
How did you get into this field?
It was completely by accident. I've been in the music industry for more than 10 years, significantly more. I've been writing music for, you know, screen, film, TV. There was just one time when I decided that I wanted to write music for a game. What the game needed that I had pitched for, I couldn't do any of that. And so I found somebody that actually could do it. And it just ended up being like a really smooth, awesome kind of process. The guy afterwards asked me, do you have any more work for me? And then I was like, huh. And the light, you know, flicked on and yeah.
You have composers and sound designers in your ranks. Now, what's the difference there in relation to video game audio?
Composers are music composers, so they'll write the original music and soundtracks to a game. Sound designers are the people that record, create, edit, mix, and implement sound effects. There are also vocal actors who do their own, you know, processing of the vocal sound effects that they do and then implement them into the game as well. So I guess sound design kind of spans across like quite a few different fields, but if I'm going to say composer, I'm referring to music. If I say sound design, it's literally to do with sound effects, dialogue.
So what do you look for when you're finding musicians?
Within the game industry, for a composer to really excel, they have to be quite diverse with what they do. No two games should really be having the same soundtrack. For instance, if we're going to talk about music, you need to know how to make certain music work with certain games. And if it doesn't work, then you need to figure out, you know, what will work and can you produce that. So to basically say what I look for is not so much the people who are significantly diverse across all the genres that game developers would look for. It's more so that I'm looking for the aces, the kings, the queens of their field. And if they're significantly exceptional with what they do in those those genres, then I work with them. But not just like good at writing music, they have to be fast at writing it. They need to never have a problem with their tool. They need to know how to make something work with a game, which is not just writing music. It's in mixing and it's in actually instrument selection and everything. So it's a pretty hard thing to break down like what I actually look for, but there is a little special thing that I look for, and it's not in many people, to be honest. And yeah, most people think of me as like a bit of a bastard because, like, you know, I end up not being able to work with them because I can't, literally cannot work with them.
What makes good game music?
It depends on what the game is actually needing for the music, because there are cases where games, all they need is like a licensed track that's from a band. Like, I'm pretty sure Far Cry had this track, was it by Skrillex? During like one like moment where you're just basically going and like mowing down a lot of people, and the dubstep over the top of that was just mind-blowing for a lot of players. So sometimes it's as simple as just finding the right song that can kind of work with the situation. Other times there are situations where, like, within the game they have, say, like a jukebox element where you actually have to find a bunch of songs that can play, like, for instance, Tony Hawk Skater, right? They chose those songs to create the character of that game. So if they just chose any old songs, you wouldn't have the same nostalgia that you have about Tony Hawk. There's so many different ways of having music in a game that it's hard to actually answer what's good for it. You know, it's really about the character of the music that they decide to place into a game. But if you're doing original music for a game, if it's like a game that needs an underscore, typically you need it to support whatever the gameplay is, and it needs to actually encompass the atmospheric character of the game itself. Like, if we're going to think of Skyrim, you couldn't exactly have electronic music in that. You need an orchestral underscore score to support that fantasy world, support what the player's doing in the game and immerse them into the game. And it's kind of hard because you have to write music in a way that's counterintuitive to writing a song. You know, you're not writing songs anymore, you're writing underscore. And then there's you know, games where they need simply like over-the-top gameplay themes, where if we're talking about old school games like Mega Man, got like the Dr. Wily theme and all of that, like just completely like bombastic. Even though it's like chip music, you can't imagine how explosive that kind of was at the time.
So you said you fend off a lot of hopeful musicians and sound designers. What makes a good muso for video games?
Well, it's not so much that I fend them off, for one, because I definitely do want to educate more composers that are aspiring to work within the game industry. There are a lot of people who call themselves composers, but really they haven't actually thought about what's involved, and they haven't developed their skills to be a composer. They're a musician who writes music, but far as profession goes, they haven't really taken the first steps. And if I can see in people who approach me that they have actually thought about becoming a composer by profession, but let's say they're 10 years off even being something that could be like a name that's significantly known within the game industry, I guess the equivalent of, like, you know, success as a composer, that's fine. I'll see that, I can identify that, and I'll help them along the way. I work with a lot of people like that who have, you know, started to think about, you know, what they need to do to become a composer in the game industry, and they've made these choices on their own, and they started developing these skills on their own, and I haven't had to say to them, you need to do this, 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 and this. So it's the kind of like the whole help those who can help themselves kind of thing. A lot of people come to me and they want me to do everything for them, and that's not feasible for me, and it sucks because I would love to be able to, like, do masterclasses or be able to do I don't know, just one-on-ones with a lot more people and just like educate everyone in the industry how to approach this, but lack of resources, lack of time, I simply just can't do it. I'm getting to the point where I might be able to do that, you know, in the next couple of years.
What are your favorite games as far as sound is concerned?
There's so many good soundtracks out there musically, and there's incredible audio design and just audioscapes as far as modern games and old games go. Like, we worked on this game recently with a hipster whale, Pac-Man 256, and we got given the original Pac-Man sound effects from Bandai Namco to edit and use within the new game. So we added, you know, our own touches. Well, the sound designer is Christopher Larkin. He's a credible, like, composer and sound designer. He basically got these sound effects, and we were both listening to them, and we're just like, how do you beat this? Like, how do you make this better? Because the sound effects that they made back then, I've never come across anything that sounds as incredible as those. And you're thinking, like, but that's an old synthy sound. But whatever they did to actually make those sounds, no doubt, took a lot of time and a lot of love. And, like, there was significant passion like that and skill that went into, like, those sounds. And it's just crazy to think that back then they made something so masterful. And, like, there's very few games these days that I hear as much detail put into what they did for that. Saying that, games like Alien Isolation, the audio in that, incredible. Music, I'm a real fan of old school Japanese video games, so Castlevania Symphony of the Night, the soundtrack in that is just amazing. Like, I love that one so much. It's like super baroque early music, kind of inspired rock and metal and stuff like that.
That was Fabian Malabello of the Otherworld Agency, and you can check out his website at theotherworldagency.com. Fabian has been kind enough to give us some links and information for anyone interested in getting into music and sound for video games. And you can hear it. You can head to our website, pixelsift.com.au, and check out the episode 20 information to find out all about that. The music that we heard in the background there was off their upcoming game, Obliteraces, as well. So do check that one out.
Visit us on pixelsift.com.au.
Everyone's got a guilty pleasure, and sometimes that guilty pleasure can be a movie or a game or something like that, which objectively is quite terrible, not critically acclaimed. If you go on your review aggregate websites, it will probably have something pretty poor. But
Dating Sims.
Despite that, despite Dating Sims, you may enjoy a game. And what we're going to be asking you, and we'll be asking ourselves today, is can a game be so bad that it is good?
Oh, well, absolutely. I think so, yeah.
All right, so hang on. So are we talking ironic design, or are we talking just a bad game?
I think there's an aspect of it for both. Mm. So some people will now try and make games which are, you know, designed to be ridiculous or designed to be
a bit naff.
Yeah, or they're designed to do things badly. And then there's games that just do things badly and are still fun to play. So, you know, we have seen sort of a revival of this sort of quite difficult, quite sort of sometimes glitchy and weirdly designed games, something like, you know, Goat Simulator, which is basically a, you know, a glitch simulator sort of thing. And
it's
takes
so
that sort
good.
Of, you know, the jokes of like, you know, whenever they brought in physics engines and all the crazy stuff that happens in a physics engine, you know, that sort of game. But then you also have got games which are just, you know, haven't quite made the grade.
Well, one along that, the poor physics and based on glitch kind of, or embracing glitch, a game that I played heavily, which I love and also is a bit of a contentious one, Thrasher Skate and Destroy. Don't know if you're all fans. I was a big skater back in the day, so loved it. Anyway, it was a really good game. It was quite hard, especially compared to Tony Hawk, so it wasn't as critically acclaimed or popular. But when you stacked it in that, like, your body just went nuts, folded in half, legs flipping up everywhere, and it was really entertaining. That and the soundtrack was pretty dope.
So would that be like design or ironically like or bad?
I feel like it was done, you know, it was on purpose. Not ironically, because it wasn't, you know, taking the mickey out of anything. It was just a part of like you stacked it and you were just like, and everywhere. But that was a really funny game in general. So they were pretty clever and onto it. It was definitely a choice.
Yep. And there's plenty of other great examples of that where, you know, basically everything kind of falls apart.
Just goes to shit. But in the most hilarious of ways.
A game we played recently is Screen Cheat. That has a pretty fun ragdoll
Yeah,
and for the briefest moment, though, like the ragdoll's pretty funny.
Basically, yeah. Uses that particular physics sort of as a design joke.
Yeah. No,
screen sheet, not a bad game.
No,
actually,
no, no.
A fantastic
game.
No,
no, no. I didn't,
but
that's not what I meant.
Ridiculous physics done for comedic effect, I guess. And you can, ironically.
Yeah, and you can see games that have used that not for comedic effect, but just through the way that they've sort of designed the game themselves. So.
I mean, this is a term in Japan, and I pardon any Japanese speaking people out there if I get this wrong, but kusoge. Which is for their cult classics, and it basically translates to shit game.
And it's kind of...
I love that.
It's designed, and if you have a look at this, it is basically a term that is sort of to appreciate games that aren't quite the best game in the world, but they have a heart of gold, or you know, maybe you think, oh, wow, this game has really touched me in a way that I, you know, or potentially for a lot of games that I would have played in my youth, they're games that you probably wouldn't have another opportunity to basically play anything else, so you love the game you're with, not the one that you're hoping for.
Yeah, exactly. When I was... Not a very young game, I guess, for me, myself, as playing it, because it was only a few years back, but Dynasty Warriors... It's a, you know, just a hack and slash, but I loved that game and I'd poured so many hours into it. I don't know which one, a couple of them actually, to be fair. Any Tony Hawk, I guess, after number 4, I feel. It got a bit cheesy and crappy after that, but, you know, the gameplay is still the same. The gameplay is probably just as gold, if not better. But
do you know, I was thinking of here's a good example. So we did the profile for the earlier thing we were talking about, gamer motivations. And one of my gamer motivations is to be a completionist and to collect as many things as possible. So as part of that, I picked up a game that was on Steam, and it was part of the much maligned and much hated Games for Windows Live, which linked into your PC games into the Xbox Live achievements and gave you achievement points in that. So one of the first games I picked up on Steam was a real-time strategy game that I cannot even remember the name of. And it wasn't a great game. It was quite... I mean, I'm of the Blizzard era genre of real-time strategy people.
So you've got pretty high standards when it comes to RTS.
But I played through it, and I tell you what, it still has a place in my heart. As something that was kind of a big part of my first Steam experience, which sort of led on to other things after that. So.
Well, we had a debate earlier, well, a small debate. I said Driver 3. I wasn't impressed with that, but you guys loved it.
That was a game that did
have good physics, yeah.
And for me, like, because I played Driver and Driver 2, it was the first of the drivers where you could actually, you know, get in... You could do the real world stuff like GTA kind of thing. I can't think of the bloody word.
Get in out of your car.
Shoot people and stuff. I can't remember what Driver 2 stopped you at. I feel as if you couldn't even get out of your car in Driver 2. I know you couldn't in number 1.
Mm.
But in 2, possibly you could, but you couldn't actually do anything. It was just like a novelty.
The first Driver, actually, that came out on the PlayStation.
Yeah, PlayStation
back
days.
In the day, even before Driver 3. That was one of those games where you would just randomly clip something and your car would be flipped into the air and you'd be spinning for like 30 or 40 seconds.
Especially
randomly.
If you had the burn-up button on all the
time. Yeah, and you would just be... Sometimes you'd be just driving down a normal road and all of a sudden, clip, you've ripped through a building, you're now falling through an infinite space until your car eventually hits a point and you basically respawn.
So. Tony Hawk's is a big one for that with me, just to bring it back. Glitch City. Other terrible games, I guess. The South Park game on PlayStation. I played the 64 one a lot more, and apparently that was a lot better than the PlayStation one, but the PlayStation one was terrible. It got terrible reviews, and I don't know anybody that liked it. But, you know, South Park, no, big name, especially in those years.
South Park was a high-value brand. It still is.
This is like pre-Family Guy, it was Simpsons and South Park.
That was the kind of it. Speaking of sort of tie-in games, one of the games from the PlayStation 1 era that my brother was absolutely obsessed with, and me and my other brother, I've got two brothers, and would always try to wrestle the controller out of his hand. He used to love the Rugrats in Paris game.
Oh, wow.
And that game was Glitch City 2. He loved it.
Yeah.
He loved it. He was right within it. And in the age, you know, bracket and the audience bracket. But, it was just a game that, you know, had a heart, a place in his heart, basically.
And one that has a place in a lot of other people's hearts, which I might get a bit of flack for because I hate it, Duke Nukem. Terrible game based around terrible plots and ideas and cheese. It's a cheese fest, in my opinion. And again, to go Nintendo 64,
I think
was the worst. Just terrible.
I think in like the... When was it made? Like in the 80s, right?
Mid-90s.
Originally?
Mid-90s? Mm. Yeah. Like that was like... All those jokes are like funny still. And then like when they remade it in what, 2000 and... I think.
Yeah, it didn't.
11, I think. Yeah. That was just like not funny.
It didn't Duke keep well.
It didn't make the transition over into the modern
the
day.
The best part about those Duke Nukems were those pre-orders from like 12 years prior.
Yeah.
And like the people holding up their receipts and like there's like, I'm wondering whether they'll get, we'll get like the receipt renewed or like valued. Yeah.
Very, very interesting.
I feel like all casual social games, anything that's on a Facebook game, is in this category because, like, they are bad. We all know they're bad. But so many people play them constantly, like, because to an extent they are good. They reel people in and keep them coming back. And it's not because they're a good... Well, it's not because they're the best games, but there's something good in them, obviously. Well,
there's got to be something in them because of the people are playing them. They've got to have some value in there somewhere.
Mm. Even if we don't see it, somebody is.
Very, very true. We're hoping that you've seen a bit of value in us and we've got something in us that will keep you coming back.
We just lost our listeners.
That's where
when I dissed Driver 3.
That's right. Yeah, we're coming up to the end of this episode. So thank you very much for joining us again for another episode of Pixel Sift. This has been our 20th episode. We've done this for 19 episodes previous to this, and this is now the 20th one. Thank you for joining us. We hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll be, as usual, we'll be putting links up on our website, which is pixelsift.com.au. We've got some links up there from Fabian. Thank you very much, Fabian, for providing those to us. Scott, where can people find us on social media?
Gianni, they can find us at facebook.com/pixelsift, twitter.com/pixelsift, twitch.tv/pixelsift, and youtube.com/pixelsiftau.
And Mitch, people want to listen to other episodes, where are they going to?
Yep, so you can go to our site to stream the episodes or subscribe to our podcast on either iTunes or Pocket Cast, or you can use the RSS links on our page if you are all about those.
And if you want to give us a rating and review on iTunes, that would be fantastic. We've also got a Steam group, so join up on there, find it all.
We have a Steam group?
We sure do.
I should join that.
We should definitely. Yeah, you definitely should. That's all we've got time for, so we'll see you guys again next week.
Laters.
How do you join the Steam group?
Did you know that the original Final Fantasy creator, Hironobu Sakaguchi, made a spiritual successor to that legendary series called Fantasian for Apple Arcade, and every level in the game is a handmade, physical miniature model? Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a 1 month free trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. This offer is for new subscribers only. $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled.